May it please the court. Good morning.
Good morning.
Following the hearing on this matter of N. Ray Brandon Williams that was held on August 15th, the disciplinary hearing panel issued its decision in this case. The panel found that the respondent violated Rule 4-1.15D by receiving client funds and not promptly notifying clients and turning them over to them, 4-5.3B by not making reasonable efforts to ensure that his paralegal's conduct were in accordance with his responsibilities of his professional duties, and 4-8.4B, C, and D, due to his acts of his paralegal in forging names on settlement agreements and on checks and failure to notify clients of the settlement funds were received and failure to deposit those funds in the trust account. Respondent is therefore subject to discipline, and the informant believes that a one-year state suspension, as found by the panel, plus 1 year of probation is appropriate in this case and supported by Missouri case law and the ABA standards for imposing sanctions. Specifically, with regard to case law, in N. Ray Wiles, the respondent there was admonished several times over 3 years, including admonishments for commingling client funds into an operating account, and had two prior disciplinary admonitions in Kansas, as well as a public censure in Kansas, which resulted in the reciprocal disciplinary case in which it was founded. The respondent in this case had three violations, three rules in 4 years and 14 years of practice. In N. Ray Coleman, there were two admonitions and a public reprimand, including unreasonable fee case in the prior history, and in the case that was before the court, there were five new violations, including commingling of funds and paying bills from his trust account, but the court found that a state suspension was appropriate.
Can I go ahead.
I am unaware of a prior case where there's a circumstance such as being responsible for a staff person's forgery of client signatures to obtain money from them.
A forgery?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. And so,
so it's not just commingling or misappropriation. The forging seems different than other cases.
Yes, so there was a forgery by the paralegal in this case, and you're right in terms of the allegations that were filed. I believe N. Ray Bell's had a forgery element to it, but that was a different case altogether in that it dealt with some mental health conditions and things of that nature. But I agree, you're absolutely correct. But in this case, I think that the reason why the disciplinary hearing panel found correctly and found that probation was likely or was the appropriate way to go, because in looking at the gravity of what was done and the aggravating and mitigating factors that went on to it, that probation was appropriate because it was unlikely that he was going to harm the public during the period of probation and that he could be supervised adequately. Specifically, this time when the two matters occurred, when he was not being as diligent in managing his practice as he should, he was suffering through several tragedies in his personal life that caused him to be away from the office. And might add that during the 4 or 5 years since both of these matters came to him, he has no disciplinary history as a result.
That kind of ties in with my question. In the cases you cite, the attorney committed the misconduct himself. Here, if I understand correctly, you, the OCDC and the DHP both say he didn't do it, he didn't know anything about it, but it was very serious, even criminal misconduct, and he failed to supervise and become aware of it when he should have.
Correct, but you're right. He did not commit the misconduct himself.
Did he instruct his paralegal to do it?
He did not instruct his paralegal to do it. In fact, he had given instructions to his paralegal who had worked with him prior to his extended absences from the office of the proper procedure when a settlement comes in and how to get the signatures of the client and then what processes to take as a result.
Is that in the record?
Yes, ma'am, it is in the record.
And so how do we know that won't happen again?
Well, a couple of things. So one, it came out in the hearing on this matter that he has changed his procedures in the office. He fired this particular paralegal, as a matter of fact, as well. And yes, and changed the procedures in the office. And again, I would point out that he's not had any disciplinary record since this time for any matter, much less anything of the nature in which brings us here today.
So what did the DHP find in terms of his state of mind?
Well, interestingly, the DHP found no mitigating factors in this case, which we think was quite contrary to what the record showed, as well as in reviewing that in light of the ABA standards for mitigating factors. Specifically, the respondent's brother died suddenly in the year that the representation regarding the first complaint came about. And then his grandfather, who raised him for a considerable part of his life, died 6 months later. And then within, I believe it's 8 months after that, his dad passed in a car accident driving to his wedding. And so in these complaints and the handling or lack thereof during that time, in terms of the cases that were assigned to him, were within this period. And yet the panel found no mitigating factors. Similarly, he expressed great remorse for what he had done, and as soon as he found out about it, in fact, prior to complaints being filed against him, he had made restitution in at least one of the cases in advance, and then the second case, he likewise made restitution, and yet the panel did not find that that was a mitigating factor, even though that it clearly is stated in the ABA standards.
So complete restitution's been made.
Yes, as a matter of fact, one could argue over restitution in the sense that one of the matters was settled for $3,750, but because he felt terrible and because of the time that had elapsed between when his paralegal deposited the check and when the client received the funds, he paid $12,500 of that. Similarly, in the other case where the settlement was $7,500, he paid over the entirety of the $7,500 and did not take out a fee for that. And so,
was that, though, because he had that agreement from the very beginning?
No, ma'am.
To take a fee?
No, ma'am. He was supposed to have gotten a fee for his services in both cases.
What was the longest delay?
The longest delay was 22 months. The longest delay was 22 months, yes. And so he was unaware that the funds had not been, or that the settlement check had come in and hence been deposited and not been paid over until 2015. But once he found out, he paid within weeks of learning of the matter.
But in the Turner case, he paid the restitution to the mother, not the minor child, who was no longer a minor at that time and would be entitled to the money and not the mother. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. So that was one of the other things that he did not take the steps to realize that the child was no longer a minor by the time he was making the payment. And so you're absolutely correct that he did make the payment of the $7,500 to the mother. And subsequently, and prior to the disciplinary hearing panel, the child filed a lawsuit against Mr. Williams arising out of that very fact. And as it would turn out, the day before the hearing panel, the courts dismissed that case with prejudice. As a matter of fact, the case that the minor child had filed against him.
But arguably, the minor child now has to try to recover this money if it hasn't been resolved amicably from her mother. Is that correct?
Yes. And I do happen to know, since that proceeding, the civil court proceeding was going on at the time of the disciplinary, when we were investigating the matter, that he did make offer of settlement to pay it again, and perhaps when counsel for the respondent gets up, he can state whether they accepted or not, because I'm not quite remembering that fact, if they accepted his offers of settlement.
But he offered some money to the daughter?
Yes, ma'am. And also looking at some of the additional mitigating factors that were not followed in this case were the fact that of his character that had been fully put on the record, his reputation in the community, his character and involvement in the community. His full cooperation is also listed, is omitted, from being listed as a mitigating factor. When I stated from the beginning, before he even engaged counsel, he responded to the complaints without counsel, and he was cooperative with our office at every stage of the process, and that was put on the record, but yet the panel yet found that there were no mitigating factors. I would also like to share with you some of the thoughts on the aggravating factors that they did find, because several of them, at least three or four, were recitations of the facts. And so there were seven items that they listed as aggravating factors, yet when you read them, they were in fact the very things that got us before, or got him, I should say, involved in the process in the first case. So for just to give you an example, the fact that it took 18 to 22 months to pay the individuals involved the funds that were at issue. Well, we don't view that as an aggravating factor when it was a fact of the matter.
They make the determination that they think that neglect of supervision of someone in his office, it wasn't for a short period of time, it was for a very lengthy time, that they characterize that, if we recognized the grades of negligence, as gross negligence for not having any supervision of your staff during that period of time on trust account issues.
That may have been their reasoning behind it, but again, we felt that, or believe that, the way that they characterized it was inappropriate in that they were reciting facts as aggravators. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Andy Kasnitz. I represent, have the privilege and honor of representing Mr. Williams in this proceeding. As usual, I prepared an argument that I'm going to move away from and try to respond to some of the good questions that were raised. Judge Breckenridge, you asked about forgery and how that had not appeared in other cases. And I looked at the cases, too, and I didn't see any. What I would suggest here, though, as a matter of importance, is that, yes, the paralegal did sign documents, did endorse checks, but that the checks went into the account of the firm and were not misappropriated or dispersed in any way. So, yes, it was wrong, and, yes, it was contrary to Mr. Williams' express procedures that he left with that paralegal. And, by the way, she had worked for him for 4 or 5 years prior to that and in the past had followed those procedures. So he had... he believed every reason to believe that she would follow those again. She did not. So yes, it was a forgery, but no, there was no misappropriation of funds. There was no, I'm not going to say there's no harm, because there was a delay in getting the money to the clients, and that there's inherent harm in that, I think. But not the kind of harm you have from misappropriating funds.
She did put at least one of the checks into the operating account. Is that correct?
That is correct.
How is that not a misappropriation of funds?
Because those funds were not used for personal gain. They remained in the operating account. Ultimately, those funds, times about almost four, were ultimately dispersed to that client. So, yes, it technically went into the operating account initially, and that's a mistake by the paralegal, and a mistake by Mr. Williams for not hands-on supervising that. But there was no personal gain from that. And I think that's the important distinction here. No misappropriation of funds.
Was there any evidence? Was an attempt to gain money by the paralegal, or was it incompetence, or what happened? Or was that not clarified?
That is, to this day, a mystery to me. I don't know. There was no evidence I'm aware of that the paralegal actually absconded with any funds.
Evidence that the operating account was short and this made the difference?
No, Your Honor. It's just a mistake that it went into the operating account instead of the trust account. And a question was raised, and I don't recall by who, about, you know, how do we know this stuff's not going to happen again? And I think that's a great question. It might have been you, Judge Stitt. The answer to that is, number one, it hasn't happened since. Number two, as soon as these occurrences took place, at the direction of the OCDC, Mr. Williams took 5 classes including on ethics, including trust fund management. He made himself the only signatory to the account, to the accounts, since there's an operating and a trust account, and he reviews everything. So all of the mechanisms that should be in place are in place now, and there have been no problems since that time. So I think there is good assurance that that's not going to happen again.
Can you clarify the issue about the daughter and her lawsuit?
I can. In fact, there's something that happened since the record was made that I want to make sure to supplement here orally today. The day before the hearing, that case was dismissed with prejudice. It was dismissed the morning before based on sanctions because they hadn't done anything about the case. We thought candidly that they had abandoned the case. The lawyer for the minor child, Michaela Turner, actually the morning of the sanction hearing did not appear, but filed a voluntary dismissal, unbeknownst to me and unbeknownst to Judge Dirk. So the order of dismissal with prejudice was entered. Subsequently, that was set aside, and there's a dismissal without prejudice as it sits right now. The second question...
Because the voluntary dismissal had already been filed.
It had been filed an hour prior, unbeknownst to me and to the court, prior to the time that the dismissal with prejudice was filed. But at the time of the hearing in this matter, we were unaware of that, and all we had was the dismissal with prejudice.
And did your client offer to settle that case at some point?
He offered to... I would characterize it as resettling the case. He had paid the full amount. It was a $7,500 settlement of a small automobile accident case, which was in fact paid to the mother after Michaela Turner had attained majority. He offered to repay an additional $7,500, which was turned down by the plaintiff's lawyer. I don't know, and I don't know whether that was ever communicated to the client or not, and I have concerns about that. So that has not been, theoretically that could be refiled. But yes, the full amount was offered again.
Wouldn't there have to be a minor settlement in order to get that case involving a minor settled to begin with?
Yes, Your Honor. The offer of settling that case, like I said, in my view, for the second time, would have required a hearing and a minor settlement.
What about the first time, though? How did the case get settled the first time without a minor settlement hearing?
What happened as a matter of fact is that after 18 months or so had gone by and my client first realized that those funds had not been turned over.
But how did the funds get turned over to his law firm without a minor settlement hearing?
The insurance company sent a check and it was deposited by his paralegal into the operating account.
Was there a case filed in circuit court in that case?
There was not.
Okay.
So the answer to your question is no to that, and if they had accepted the subsequent settlement, there would have needed to have been.
You indicate in your brief that Mr. Williams had stipulated to the DHP decision, but you also state that in your brief that you think the appropriate sanction is, quote, a public admonition.
Correct.
Which do you go with today?
If I had my choice.
And by the way, we only do reprimands, not admonitions at this level. So the public admonition is what you're, or a reprimand is what you're
a
saying.
Reprimand.
That's the lowest we can do.
That's the lowest that comes here.
Judge, to answer that question, and I think this is in the record, and perhaps it wasn't clear in the briefing. After a thorough investigation by the OCDC, including the deposition of Mr. Williams, brief negotiations were entered into, and a stipulation was entered into, whereby the admonition would be the discipline. That was presented to the panel and rejected. So, yes, I thought that was appropriate then. The OCDC thought it was appropriate then. And it's interesting on the issue of aggravating and mitigating circumstances, in that stipulation that was entered into, part of it was, quote, there are no aggravating circumstances in this matter.
mitigate the circumstances that exist in this case to support an admonition.
So there was recognition by the OCDC as soon as, after their investigation was over, and it was thorough. And as Ms. Walker said, Mr. Williams was cooperative as he could be. The file was turned over. They had conversations. He retained me. I got involved. The deposition was taken. And we expected that the matter would be resolved by that admonition. And as history tells us, it was not.
There was no selfish motive.
I'm sorry?
There was no selfish motive.
On behalf of my client?
Right.
Absolutely not.
And that was not listed as a mitigator.
Lack of a selfish motive.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Never mind. She was just saying lack of a selfish motive was not listed as a mitigator. But
and well, perhaps it should have been. Is that your position?
Perhaps. The panel found that there were no mitigating circumstances, no mitigating factors. And I guess what's most important to me, and I want to respond to your question, is that's consistent with the OCDC's position as well. That there, mm-hmm. there are in fact, that's inconsistent, there are in fact mitigating circumstances, and I think that Ms. Walker went through them, you know, in some detail. Those include his cooperation, more than full restitution made, remorse, no personal gain, no misappropriation, and other things. And I guess the question that that's always puzzled me is how this happened with the panel, why the panel went the direction that it did. And I don't know the answer. The panel, in my view, and I think the briefing is pretty clear about this, I think they were just wrong. And I'm not saying they're wrong in the discipline they assessed. I think it was too strong. I think it was more than it should be. But in the substance and the body of their opinion, I think they're just flat wrong on the law and the application of these facts to the law. There were no aggravating circumstances here. There was no ill intent. And even the panel didn't find an ill intent, to respond to you, Jessica. And the fact that they said that there were no mitigating circumstances is simply wrong based on a record that is without excuse. And it is beyond curious to me as to how they reached that opinion. I guess as I thought about it, even driving down here this morning, is that they wrote it. There were two lawyers on the panel and one layperson. One of the lawyers wrote it and sort of convinced themselves, well, there's all these aggravating circumstances, there's all these aggravating factors, and there's no mitigating factors, so we have to do severe discipline. When in fact, they were absolutely wrong in the substance of their opinion. And I don't have any other good explanation for how that came about. I guess the only other thing that I would add, and it's really in response to you, Judge Stitt, on the intent. There is nothing in the record, and I was involved in this throughout, that indicates any ill intent. It was a pretty extraordinary time in Mr. Williams' life. He relied on a paralegal who he had relied on for 4 or 5 years, and on these two matters, things were handled very poorly. And he believes, and we're not arguing otherwise, that discipline's appropriate. I do believe, and he accepted the panel's decision, even though he disagreed substantively with what they found. He agreed to stipulate to that discipline in order to conclude the matter. But in all candor, under these facts, I do think that the discipline is too strong. And as you pointed out, we're no longer in a position where an admonition is a possibility. But I would ask the panel to at least consider the record as on the whole, consider the positions that the OCD has consistently taken since the beginning of this case in their argument and in their briefing before this court. I view it as a very soft recommendation by the OCDC to accept the discipline as issued by the panel. Obviously, they were willing and thought it appropriate that an admonition was proper. I understand that it's their job to support the panel's decision, and they're doing a fine job of doing that. Notwithstanding that, in their briefing, in their argument before the panel, and the argument here today, the essence is they disagree with the substance, if not the discipline, of what the panel did. So I'd ask the court to consider all that and consider, at maximum, affirming the discipline that was issued by the panel, and perhaps consider a lesser discipline. Thank you very much.
May I? Thank you. So, Mr. Kasnetz is correct. We disagree with the analysis. We think the analysis was flawed in many regards, and I won't repeat them for you as I've done in my original argument. But I do want to highlight a couple of things again about the mitigating factors, as I think that they're important to mention again, as that there were several of them. And the absence of a dishonest or selfish motive, I think the record is clear that that is absent. That the personal problems that he was enduring in this span of time when both of these matters came about, I think the record clearly indicates that those are were present. The good faith effort to make a restitution and to rectify the consequences of his misconduct is another one. The remorse, I don't think I mentioned that in the initial context. I took his deposition, and the remorse was expressed then. In addition, it was expressed numerous times, both in writing to the panel. The panel submitted certain questions that they wanted answered in prior to our hearing, that he answered on the record, and in addition to that, at the hearing. My understanding, too, is that in both of the matters, that either directly or through their subsequent counsel, he expressed remorse to the new counsel for Ms. Kazagorenko, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, as well. And again, I would point out, I verified before I mentioned that he had instituted restitution in one of the cases before we got involved, but I looked at the record when I sat down, and in fact, it was both of the cases. And so again, it was not the Office of Disciplinary Counsel or the filing of complaints that caused him to make restitution. Rather, upon learning of this matter, he did so on his own. And again, I would think that just the failure to find any the finding of so many aggravating factors in the manner in which they were found were not in accordance with the ABA standards, which talks about there is a dishonest motive or as an aggravating factor, or that the person was non-cooperative in the investigatory process, which is an aggravating factor. And essentially, everything that we list as a mitigating factor, the opposite of those would be aggravating factors, yet the hearing panel found none of those things on the record. Thank you.
Case will be submitted.